Okay, as I mentioned a moment ago, we have just a whole lot of material to try and cover this morning. It is the nature of the material as we are now involved in our fourth class on the topic of miracles. This is by far the most thorough study that I've done of miracles in Scripture. The feedback that I've gotten from the congregation has been really very positive. I think already a couple of times I've thanked the elders. I don't know which one it was that had the original idea, but appreciate a month ago that they're suggesting that we start this class. And so I have been, dare I say, harping on in the first three classes, though, is a definition I've found, which is popular enough to be in more than one Bible dictionary. But this man, M.G. Easton, says, "A miracle is, by definition, an event in the external world brought about by the immediate agency or the simple volition of God, operating without the use of means capable of being discerned by the senses." That doesn't mean we can't see it, we don't know what happened. It's kind of a funny way that he said that. But when he says means capable of being discerned, that is that we can understand or explain natural means. So that it's above nature. And yet designed to authenticate the divine commission of a religious teacher and the truth of his message. I'll come back to that again at the end of this class, that last part about authentication of a divine commission of a teacher and of the truth of his message is a foundational, fundamental, I think, to a proper understanding of miracles. Again, now for the last 2 weeks, I've been putting up this quote from Norman Geisler in a book called When Skeptics Ask. Chapter 5 is entitled Questions About Miracles. On page 92, he said, "Christianity has better evidence, more witnesses, closer to the time of the events than any other religion. And besides this, no religion offers the kind of miracles Christianity can claim. No other religion has the record of specific prophecy or divine deliverance the Bible gives, and no other religion is any miracle that can be compared to number 5, the resurrection of Jesus Christ in its grandeur or its testimony." Again, I hadn't said this before, but to add a little bit to his definition there, he is not suggesting, when he says no other religion has any miracle that can be compared to the resurrection, that any other religion has any miracle. He's only referencing their claims. There are only a very few religions who even claim to have any sort of a supernatural verification, having a miraculous authentication of their teachers, of their origin, and of the practice of their religion. Christianity is really quite unique in that not only it's rare that anybody would claim it, but in Christianity it's not only claimed, but it's claimed hundreds of times throughout the Scripture. So it's just a marvel that Christianity is so magnificently different and superior than any other claims that any other religion has. So what we've been doing is not looking by any means at all miracles. It's a very lengthy list that you find in Scripture, and eliminating a lot of them by not referencing, but rarely in this class at least, acts of God that are very singular and distinct to God. In other words, they're not involving another human being, acts of judgment. I started most especially with creation. You know, creation by nature, I guess, is supernatural. You know, there was no nature. There was nothing physical. God, in a sovereign decree and an exercise of his power, created the universe. Well, he's not done that again. It demonstrates a superior power. But, you know, I'm not dealing with those sorts of miracles. So, what we have been focusing on, though, for instance, began in Genesis chapters 12 through the end with Abraham. That's the 1900s B.C. Now, we turned and had two classes now with regard to Moses, which is kind of arguable. Lived 120 years anyway, so it's hard to limit him, you know, to one century. But typically, I'd put 1400s. I usually think of him at 1500 if I have to put a single date. But a lot of miracles, of course, that are associated with Moses. So, as a new thought, though, and in the way of categorizing, particularly for today's lesson, what we've seen so far in Genesis in the five books of Moses altogether, Genesis and Deuteronomy, are really two distinct time periods that are separated by 500 years, in which we have Abraham as the father of a new nation, singled out for a particular race of people who God will be particularly interested in and use as an example for all the rest of the world. So we saw the establishment of the Jewish nation in Abraham, and miracles are associated with him. And then, of course, we have the law. For obvious reasons, Moses is associated with the first, what we'll say, codified or codified, depending on how you like to pronounce that, but a written, arranged, well-established law for these people, the Jews. Now, this morning then, we're going to move on chronologically in world history to the book of Joshua. If I'm able, it's going to be quite the horse race this morning. I'd like to look at Joshua, I'd like to look at Judges, and I'd also like to look at 1 Samuel. So once again, and obviously, we're not going to be looking at every single miracle that's in these books. However, we are going to look at about half of them, very hurriedly. Most of the ones that we are not looking at that have to do again with some singular act of God, where He alone performs some supernatural action. But we're interested most especially when somebody is involved, when it now has an intersection with the human race and why God is using miracles with regard to those people. So we're going to race, and we're going to be condensing and editing here. So please open your Bibles to Joshua. I did not try to take the time to go through collecting all this information, splashing it up on the screen for you. We're just going to have to rush through it. But in the book of Joshua now, immediately after the time of Moses, and chronologically continuing that story, we're going to start in Joshua, the first miracle that occurs in the book, in Joshua chapter 3, and just look at verse 7 to begin with. The Lord said to Joshua, "This day I will begin to what?" What does the verse specifically say? "Today I'm going to begin to exalt you." Whatever this is that follows, it's about setting Joshua apart and above. It's about making a very big deal out of him. "I'll begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel." So what I'm about to do is to prove to them something about you, how you're elevated, that they may know, the verse 7 continues, that just as I've been with Moses, I'll be with you. Now that's huge. We looked at 1 Corinthians 10, the first few verses, in a couple of those classes, baptizing Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And we saw then what I think is a profoundly important principle found in that, my view, kind of neglected verse there, 1 Corinthians 10, 4, to see that what was happening in the crossing of the Red Sea and in the appearance of the pillar of smoke and fire, is that the people were being directed toward the leadership of Moses. They were being baptized into him, that is, immersed into him. His mission was being authenticated. So here we have exactly the same thing with Joshua, who is his successor, his immediate successor. "This day I'll begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that just as I've been with Moses, I'll be with you." Now in 9 and 10, Joshua said to the sons of Israel, "Come here and hear the words of the Lord your God." And Joshua said, "By this you shall know that the living God is among you. Now, by what is about to happen, you'll know that God is among you, that He's with you. You are being singled out and exalted above other people. And that He will assuredly dispossess from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, and the Jebusite." And then skipping again to verse 13, "It shall come about
when the soles of the feet of the priests who carry the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, and the waters which are flowing down from above shall stand in one heap. So as the book of Joshua opens, God makes a big deal out of saying, so that Israel will understand that I'm with you, Joshua, the same way I was with Moses. We're going to cross this sea, or this river, the way we cross the Red Sea. There will be a miraculous stopping, standing wall-like waters that will demonstrate when you came out of Egypt, I rescued you, and now that I'm bringing you into the promised land, I'm introducing you to that land, you know, the same way I did when I brought you out of Egypt. We're going to have a miraculous effect upon waters. So in the crossing of the Jordan, two things happen. Everybody sees the exaltation of Joshua, and they see the presence of God among them. Both Joshua and the people in this miracle are set apart from everybody else. Then in chapter 6, so the 6th chapter, you know right well, it's all about the fall of Jericho. It's a fascinating site when you visit in Israel. It is one of the two or possibly three contenders for the oldest known city on earth. You go to Israel and you visit Jericho, you look down into an excavated pit going back millenniums to what is likely the oldest human structure ever built. So, or ever found, at least, you know, on the surface of the earth. Here's circular structure that is the oldest known to man. Well, you know, we know the story of Jericho, but so to save time, skip down to verse 27, the last verse in the chapter there, where it says, so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. There's a whole chapter about the fall of Jericho, a lot of interesting material there. But what's the point in the last verse? It is, so in the fall of Jericho, the Lord is with Joshua, and his fame is in all the land. So exactly what we saw in chapter 3 and verse 7 is played out again as they've come across the Jordan miraculously and conquered their first city, also, obviously, undeniably, miraculously. Now we're going to skip to chapter 10. And when I say skip, it's not that I'm skipping miraculous events. It's just that there aren't any. And so we come to the next one now, four chapters later, in chapter 10, in verses 12 through 14. Joshua spoke to the Lord the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel, and he said, in the sight of Israel. So once again, very public event. O son, he says in the presence of all Israel, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon, in the valley of Aijalon. I've been in the valley of Aijalon a couple of times now. 13. So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jasher? And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky, did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And there was no day like that before or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man. For the Lord fought for Israel. Now, it is an awesome thing when you visit, you know, Israel endlessly. I mean, it's just, I've been four times, I've spent 12 weeks there, haven't seen everything by any means. These events, brethren, actually took place, and it's fun. Stand in the Valley of Aijalon, look out there, and then, you know, look up and see the sun, and then imagine that it just stops. And as time's going by, whether you got a wristwatch or not, back in those days, you know, time is not happening right now. The sun isn't moving, and as long as it, you know, remains daytime, we are conquering our enemies. So again, look at verse 14, and this study is all about trying to identify what does God say the miracles are for, not what people fantasize that they're for, not what they imagine that they're about, not what most denominational churches teach about it today, but what the Bible actually says about these miracles. So in 10:14, there was no day like it, before or after, when what? The Lord listened to the voice of a man, and the Lord fought for Israel. So, just like we saw in chapter 3 and verse 7, just like we saw at the end of chapter 6, what does this event do for Joshua? It exalts him. There's nobody like this. He can say this, "Sun stands still in front of all Israel." He's got all those witnesses. And then what happens? Well, we got a beautiful day out there. I'll just park the sun for 6 or 8 hours. Well, let's just keep this day. What do you say? Sun, stand still. What are my chances? None. But what if it happened? Okay, then next time I ask you to do something, you'd probably be pretty quick. Whoa, this guy's different. That's the point. He's different. He's exalted. Joshua is being singled out. Now watch this. This is kind of fun. Toward the end of Joshua and then at the end of Joshua, first in chapter 21 at verses 44 and 45. So last two verses of chapter 21 now. The Lord gave them rest on every side according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of all their enemies stood before them. Jericho couldn't do it. The Valley of Ajalon, the sun stood still against those Amalekites. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand. Now, 45. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass. Now turn to page or two. To chapter 23, the next to the last chapter in the book. And in 23, verse 14. Now behold, today I am going the way of all the earth. And you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God spoke concerning you has failed. All have been fulfilled for you. Not one of them has failed. Now here's Joshua at the end of his life making the declaration as he's come to his death, time of his death, and two chapters earlier, both times he's declared, which one of God's promises to any of the Jewish forefathers has not been fulfilled? Nary one. So, in the book of Joshua, and as you look at it right now, the miracles in Joshua, the book's named after the man, are singularly all about whom? The guy the book's named after. It's all about Joshua. Joshua is to be exalted because God's going to be with Joshua the same way what? The same way that he was with Moses. But it's this category that I'm adding to these charts here now that I want you to see. Is the time of Abraham and what God does with Abraham different than the time of Moses and what God does with Moses? Yeah, they're really different. See, Abraham doesn't, go up on a mountain and get 10 commandments. Abraham doesn't receive, 5 books that deal with the law for the Jews. But Moses did. Moses is all about law. Abraham's not all about law. Abraham is about selecting an individual who will be the father of this nation, and in prophecy, the father of many nations. When Joshua takes over as the immediate successor to Moses, is his life story very similar to Moses? He's just the next guy. But does he live a life like Moses? Not at all. So, in Joshua, what is Joshua's job in a single word? It is the conquest of Palestine, Israel, promised land, flowing with milk and honey, You know, it's about getting rid of that list of nations we read a few moments ago so the Jews can possess this land. The iniquity of the existing nations there is now full. God cannot tolerate them anymore. Their time of judgment has come. The Jews are not moving in here just out of greed. It is a divine action of punishment on these people and establishment for this the Jews. But the time of conquest is not like the time of wilderness wanderings and the reception of the law. And it's not like the time of Abraham either. It's a very unique, distinct, obvious sort of circumstances going on when we're having this collection of miracles. Now, I warned you, we're going to really have to rush on. So there's Joshua. And surprisingly, not very many miracles in the whole book at all. So now, let's turn a page and we go to the next book. And again, the chronology continues so far, each one of these books, taking us right straight through the history. So now in the book of Judges, the first passage we're going to look at is chapter 6. And the sixth chapter of Judges, beginning at verses 20 and 21. So 6:20 of Judges. The angel of God said to him, this is Gideon, take the meat and the unleavened bread, lay them on this rock, and pour out the broth. And he did so. And then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And then the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. So we have two miracles. This time, an angel is performing them in the presence of Gideon. I got to go back here. But if you'll skip now down to 36 through 40 of this same chapter. Chapter 6, 36, to the end of the chapter now. Gideon said to God, if you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken, behold, I will put fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and it's dry on all the ground, then I'll know you'll deliver Israel through me as you've spoken. And it was so. When he rose early the next morning, squeezed the fleece, he drained the dew from the fleece, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, do not let your anger burn against me that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on all the ground. God did so that night, for it was dry only on the fleece, dew was on all the ground. Now, in both of these events, with the angel and now with Gideon's directly conversing with God, what's the point of both of those? Why, well, I put them on one line, two different events, but what are we doing? Same thing was done with Joshua, selecting the man. Now, in this case, There don't appear to be any other witnesses. Maybe there were, but if so, I'm unaware of it. It doesn't seem to be mentioned. So in the choosing of Gideon this time, though, he's saying, as you said, this is what you said about me. Gideon himself is understanding, I'm being commissioned for a particular work. Now, please skip to chapter 15 in the book of Judges. Chapter 15, you can look at verses 14 through 17. 15, verse 14. Then he came to Lehi, and the Philistines shouted as they met him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that the ropes that were on his arms were as flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds dropped from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. So he reached out, took it, and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've killed 1,000 men. And it came about when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand. He named that place Ramoth Lehi. Now, in this case, I'm personally, I guess, declaring this to be a miracle. Is it possible that a guy in the normal order of things could pick up, you know, a bony size lion there and kill 1,000 people with it. You know, seems more than unlikely. You know, I suppose you could argue, well, maybe, you know, but I'm calling this one a miracle. So we have the slaying of these Philistines, and who's the chief figure now? We went from Gideon to Samson. Chapter 16, next chapter, verse 3. Now, Samson lay until midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of the doors of the city gate and the two posts and pulled them up along with the bars, put them on his shoulders, carried them up the top of the mountain, which is opposite Hebron. Now, once again, you know, maybe, but it doesn't seem possible. So in this case, again, at least it is an extremely singular kind of event. Who is also involved this time? Samson. Now comes chapter 16, and look at verses 27 through 31. 16:27. House was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. About 3,000 men and women were on the roof looking on while Samson was amusing them. And he wasn't intending to, of course, but they were abusing him, not mocking him. 28. Samson called to the Lord and said, O Lord God, please remember me, and please strengthen me just this time, O God, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. And Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, braced himself against them, the one with his right hand, the other with his left. Samson said, Let me die with these Philistines. And he bent with all his might, so that the house fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he killed in his life. Then his brothers and all his house, father's household came down, took him, brought him up, buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of Manoah his father. Thus he had judged Israel for 20 years. What did I do wrong here? So I've got Dagon's fall there. And apparently I've got the wrong scripture. So my apologies there. I don't know what went wrong. But you remember Dagon fell, you know, across the threshold. And that too, they propped him back up, fell back down again. You know, it's a miraculous event. So I got my chart crossed. But nonetheless, with Gideon, in three events with Samson, what we have is a unique period of time. What book are we in? Judges. Gideon is a judge. Samson is a judge. What does it say about him in the last verse of chapter 16? Does he judge for 20 years? So, in the choosing of Gideon, throughout also the lifetime of Samson's judging, and even in his death, what is God doing through these miracles? He is communicating directly with the judges, and therefore ruling over the Jews directly. God tells the judge tells the people. All the judge is doing is passing this information on to the people. So we use this fancy word, theocracy, because I needed to find a single word to put on the chart. Call it what you will, but divine rule, I think, was the first thing that came to mind, the direct rule of God. But is the period of judges different than the time of Joshua? The two books are altogether different. When Joshua's book starts, it's all about conquest. When it ends, what about conquest? Well, there's going to be some more. But there's more cities to take, more territory. But all the promises have been fulfilled. Are the people fully established in Israel? They're just simply going to be getting more of same. Yes. And then comes the theocracy. So throughout the period of judges, not so much all the fighting, because the people are what? They're living in the cities. The prophecy is fulfilled. Cisterns that you didn't dig, you know, vineyards that you didn't plant, all of it has come to pass. These good things have been fulfilled. But brother, what I'm noticing at least is I'm going down painstakingly looking at all these different miracles. It began to leap off the page. Huh. There are unique circumstances, clearly different nature of events when we have miracles here and here and here and then here. So in my own mind, something was beginning to take shape that you're now seeing on the slides here this morning. So we come to 1 Samuel. It looks like I'm going to be okay. At this point, I think I'm going to make it with all this material. So I know I'm really rushed and all that, but you're familiar with these passages. Now we come to 1 Samuel. So after Judges, what's the next book? Well, it's Ruth. There's a little sidelight in there. Are there any miracles in there? No miracles. But we're going to then turn just two pages in my Bible, and what's the next book? It's 1 Samuel. And it begins with the period of the judges during which Ruth lived. So all this material, even though Ruth is an unusual book, we've got continuity in the time frame. And you'll see in a moment an important continuity, because to that continuity is added a new thought. So in 1 Samuel now, we come to chapter 3 and in verse 1. 3:1. The boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli. Eli is a judge. We've got another judge. So he is a minister to the Lord and to Eli. And word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. Really, I've been a Christian a while, so have you. And, it isn't until I'm directed, thanks to the elders and all, kudos again, to focus my attention and do some serious studying and thinking about it, that now this statement just kind of leaps off the page at me. God wanted us to know that in those days, his direct revelation from the mind of God to the mind of some representative throughout these years, the judges, has become what? Two words are used. Short one is rare, and the long one is infrequent. Okay? So there does not have to be, and I've mentioned this before in preceding classes, continuity. The crazy thinking that is so prevalent in our culture today, that miracles should be understood as a constant, as a proof for everybody in all times that God approves of you, everybody, as individual. The whole denominational world, Pentecostalism, the charismatic movement, as we've called it, that's craziness. It is about them believing that they have to have a verification from God. I can't tell you how many I've talked to, and it's a lie. And these poor people are pathetic. They're like, they have no faith at all. They've got to have God, they think, do something special for them, or they just can't believe that they're going to be saved. I had one woman chase me out of her house shouting at me, that until I spoke in tongues, I could never know that I was saved. That's just so wrong. There are times in the Old Testament when miracles are rare, and there are reasons why that's the case that I think is going to be developing. So just take note of that. It's not a given. It's not a constant, the use of miracles by God. Now, skipping down 1 Samuel 3, all the way now to the end of the chapter, in verses 15 to the end, through 21 there, Samuel lay down to mourning, the same thing, same event his choosing is being continued. He opened the doors of the house of the Lord. Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. Eli called Samuel. He said, "Samuel, my son." He said, "Here I am." He said, "What's the word that he spoke to you? Please, do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you." So he's laying a curse upon him. "May you be punished by God if you don't tell me what's been happening these last nights." So in 18, Samuel told him everything, hid nothing from him. He said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." Now for us, that pronoun, it kind of throws us off. It isn't Samuel that said, "It's good." It's Eli. "It is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him." That's Eli that said that. And 19, thus Samuel grew, the Lord was with him, let none of his words fail. All Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Focus on 20 and 21. What about this boy's visions in the night and conversations with God? 20. All Israel from Dan to Beersheba, north to south, knew that Samuel was what? Confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. He had the visions and nobody saw them. But Eli knew. And Eli is a judge. And Eli is confirming it first to Samuel and then to everybody. Samuel is a what of the Lord at the end of verse 20. He is a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again in 21 at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. What is happening to Samuel that happened to Gideon, that happened to Joshua, that happened to Moses, and happened to Abraham? Miracles are performed, and then these men are what in the sight of all Israel? They are set forth as representatives of God. They are exalted. So, they're chosen. Samuel is chosen in chapter 3 via these visions, which are a supernatural and miraculous event. Not for everybody, as so many people would have you believe. Now, chapter 5, two chapters later, in chapter 5, verses 6 through 12. Hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, it ravaged them, smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. And the men of Ashdod saw it was so, they said, the ark of God of Israel must not remain with us. His hand is severe on us and on Dagon, our God. So, as you skip over here, let's see, the judging, is it at, that's not it. Again, I was juggling so many verses, and I'm not surprised that I got some of this wrong. So, not to fear here, but turn to 6. Oh, I think I see what happened. I think the chapter 6 that was on that preceding chart was supposed to be on that chart, and that's where I got them crossed. And the Dagon thing was over there. It was supposed to be over here. That's because what it was is I copied these charts, and then I feel, oh, man, I think I got that one wrong. Okay, so anyway, I got it out of order. But here you go. So Dagon falls here now, and you have in chapter 6 and verse 5, you shall make likenesses of your tumors, which we just read about in chapter 5, 6 through 12, and likenesses of the mice that ravaged the land, which hadn't been mentioned before in chapter 5. And you shall give glory to the God of Israel, perhaps he'll ease his hand from you, your gods, and your land. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts when he had severely dealt with them? Did they not allow the people to go, and they departed? So now again, I'm leaning heavily on your past biblical knowledge. The ark, and the tabernacle, but the ark especially, has been captured by the Philistines. They're going to keep it and touring around Philistine city. They have nothing but trouble, plagues of tumors and of mice. Finally, they want to send it back, so they're going to send it back. But in all of this, what are the Philistines learning? These are miraculous events, these plagues and these mice, but these things prove to them this box and the God that had it built and that it represents and through which these people worship, that God is really dangerous. We need to get rid of this, the ark, because God is with them. Now come to chapter 28. I hope. Get these charts crossed. So in 1 Samuel 28 now, and starting in verse 11. Ah, the witch of Endor. Okay, so we're good on this one. All right, so 28:11 through 15. The woman said, whom shall I bring up for you? He said, bring up Samuel for me. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice. The woman spoke to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me? For you're Saul. And the king said to her, do not be afraid. But what do you see? The woman said, I see a divine being coming up. What's his form? old man wrapped in robe, and Saul knew that it was whom? Samuel. 15. Samuel said to Saul, "You're going to die tomorrow." And he does. Now, quickly, brethren, I need these 5 minutes and maybe a few more. Run over to the New Testament. This is a part of the grand climax for this morning's class. This is really important in life for you. Try to remember this and even, you know, jot the note down, go back and enter it in your Old Testament, you know, as well. This series of three verses, two in the book of Acts and one in the book of Hebrews, you know, is New Testament revelation about Old Testament individual and Old Testament individual and who he or what he represents in biblical history. So in Acts chapter 3, first, look at verses 24 and 25. "Likewise, all the prophets who have spoken from Samuel and his successors onward also announce these days. It is you who are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant which God made with your fathers, saying to Abraham and your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Skip to chapter 13 in the book of Acts. And in both cases, you can learn something about Samuel. In this first book of Samuel, we've seen Samuel chosen. We've seen events that are taking place in his life until after he's died, he's raised from the dead. There's a miracle for you. Had the conversation with Saul. All of these things revolving around the life of Samuel in chapter 13 and verse 20. "After these things, he gave them judges until" what? Until Samuel, the what? The prophet. What did chapter 3 say? Beginning with Samuel, the prophet. Now come on over to Hebrews. In Hebrews 11, look now at verse 32. Long list of the faithful, you know, Hebrews 11. You're so familiar with that chapter. Hebrews 11, 32. "What more shall I say? Time will fail me if I tell of Gideon." What was Gideon? Judge. Barak. What was Barak? Judge. Samson. What was Samson? Judge. Jephthah? Judge. But now watch. David. Will David be a judge? No. Samuel and the prophets. Now David and Samuel are going to come together. And three times now, when you say Samuel, what does the New Testament add? From him on, the prophets. There's a category in God's mind. While there's been prophets, Aaron was a prophet to Moses, Moses is a prophet to Pharaoh. We have prophets in the Old Testament. But there's this group and this time frame and God's emphasis and focus. From Samuel on, what do we have? The prophets. Okay. The prophets. So here's my summary chart. Maybe I will get it in the next minute. What have we seen in Genesis through 1 Samuel? Here is what we have found. Abraham and the chosen people who come from him. Moses and the establishment of the law for those chosen people. Joshua, establishing their presence in the land. This is going to mess up my chart, I see. Judges through Gideon, where God is ruling through those judges in the land. Judges through Samson, sorry, my chart went bad. Where God is also ruling in the land. And then 1 Samuel, where we have the prophets. What does this mean? And here, brethren, is where I hope it, you know, it all comes to fruition, leaped off the page for me. Abraham is in the 1900s. Moses is in the 1400s. Joshua's in the 1400s. Judges and Gideon is 1200s. Judges through Samson is 1100s. And then, see, it didn't light up. But with Samuel then, the prophet in the 1000s. What I want you to see is how rare miracles are. So we're reading all these passages and lengthy descriptions, and you start thinking, wow, miracles are everywhere. How? Hundreds of years go by with no miracles. The times when visions are rare and infrequent. 500 years between Abraham and Moses. 200 years between Moses / Joshua and these judges. Another 100 years to the end of the judges. Another 100 years for Samuel. Are miracles a constant, or by their nature they are physically unusual? But chronologically, what are they also? Very unusual. When you see miracles, God is making a point.